Welcome, everyone. I think there are a few people who weren't able to be here last week, so welcome to the Buddhist Studies class. If you haven't gotten on the email list, make sure to check with me, but you can get all the postings. Basically, all you really need to know now is the website, because we're just putting everything right up at the Buddhist Studies website, which is buddhiststudies.commongroundmeditation.org. All the postings are there. When we have recorded talks, they'll be there. Unfortunately, the talk from last week, the recording wasn't successful, so there's no way to find out what we did last week. Or Amy, you could see Amy's notes. I added a couple things today. If you didn't get a chance to check it out, I added another article. And I also added a link to Tara Brach's talk on the three refuges, which next week we'll be listening to, because originally, next week we weren't scheduled to meet because Rebecca Bradshaw was going to give a public talk. She had to change her schedule, so she's going to be speaking on August 30th. And so we have an optional gathering next Monday night. We'll sit from 7 to 7:25, stretch your legs, listen to the talk from 7:30 to 8:30, and then have a discussion about what Tara says about the three refuges. So please join in, or if you prefer, you can just listen to that talk on your own or with some friends at home. So it's just a talk that's at the dharmaseed.org website, and I sent out the link, or I put the link at our website, so you can find it there. So before I share some thoughts about the three refuges, I just thought I'd check in about the guided meditation. Maybe you got a sense that I was doing a reflection on the Buddha, not the historic Buddha, but the awakened mind that's here, if it's anywhere, and somehow, you know, encouraging myself and all of us to have a fresh attitude. It's so easy to be convinced that I'm dull, that my mind is problematic, that I have to do a lot of work in order to realize freedom, always putting it out there somewhere and hating or not liking what's here. So any comments or questions about the guided meditation instructions? And this guided meditation will be up on the website. And couple days maybe, and you can listen to it again if that would be helpful. Anything about that? Yeah, Nora. So Nora was saying that when I talked about the mind, I also talked about it as nature, and then she said it sounded so solid, and she was just asking me to comment on that. Well, I guess it depends what you mean by solid. Real, I feel okay with that word, or actual. You know, solid's a sort of funny word because normally we use solid, the word solid, you know, in a like concrete has weight, you know, and that wouldn't work for the mind to say that it has weight, the essential mind. But it's, you know, real and actual and available to be realized. So in that way, you know, I don't know if you, I didn't use the word solid. I wouldn't use the word solid, but it's there or here. And, you know, remember that emptiness that we hear a lot in Buddhism. Emptiness is referring to the absence of greed, anger, and delusion. So it's referring to the absence of distortions in the mind. And so that absence of distortions allows something to be awakened to. And even though that, you know, whatever that is that we awaken to, that we intuit, even though it can't be grasped, doesn't mean it isn't something. It's like the space in the room, you know. I'll give you $100 if you can, you know, do something or grasp the space in the room. But nobody has any doubt about there being space here. Other thoughts? Yeah, Scott. Yeah. And that's the flavor too of that, you know, that intuition or that realization that it isn't personal. It's here or it's now, but it isn't personal. Any other reflections come to mind? Yeah, Louise. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, one thing I'd get interested, you know, actually see what is the relationship between the anxiety and that intuition of emptiness. Because, for example, one possibility. Maybe, as you said, that they're sort of in a dynamic together. But it may not be that way. You may just assume that that's what's happening. It may be that when we begin to awaken to the space of the present moment or the nature of the mind, that the mind has to be subtle to awaken and to intuit that. And when the mind's subtle, it's also going to be aware of all the undercurrents of anxiety and disturbance that are operating in the mind. So one of the reasons we stay on the surface, stay busy, stay with superficial things, like what should I do tomorrow, is that we don't feel, we're not aware of the undercurrents of anxiety because we're on the surface of our lives. So this is, you know how, and at temples, cathedrals, they always have the fierce beasts guarding the entrances, you know, to scare away those who shouldn't be coming in. Well, same with, that's, I think, actually a metaphor for spiritual life, that as the mind awakens to what it doesn't know, what it hasn't realized, that awakening process is guarded by, you know, fierce-looking demons. But it's just the way that it is. You know, those demons aren't sort of anything but what's always been there, but we haven't been aware of because we're living, all of us, to some degree, superficial lives. But as we settle and the mind becomes more sensitive, the heart becomes more sensitive, and that's why we want to make sure we're not misinterpreting the anxiety or the pain. Like telling ourselves a story, oh, that fierce beast, that anxiety is there because I'm feeling threatened by the emptiness. Because emptiness actually isn't threatening to anybody. But our mind has a big habit of always wanting a story when we're feeling pain. You know, because we feel safer when we have a story about why there's anxiety. But maybe it's just anxiety, you know, just like whatever anxiety has been set in motion, you know, whatever momentum it has, then it's going to be there whenever the mind is quiet enough to be sensitive to it. And maybe we don't need a story about why it's there. And you might find that, in a sense, they can both be known, but we don't have to have an explanation like assume that it's related. It might be, but it may not be. Yeah, Gail. Yeah. Yeah, and whatever we use, you know, in terms of the teachings or concepts, you know, it's like the Buddha said once, you know, it will always be other than that. And that's the key. It's like it's just a skillful means to kind of get interested. And because you know how it is, we could talk about love for hours versus wisdom, you know, compassion and wisdom. We could talk about them differently. And then as Gail's saying, in a moment, someone could say, okay, now, you know how they do this in debate class. Now they say, okay, now switch sides. You know, and then you just make the other argument that, that what we were calling emptiness or wisdom is love, and what we were calling love is wisdom. And you could make just as good of an argument. Because they're just, the terms are just relative. You know, we're really talking about a process or a happening that's not really fragmented. It isn't, it's just one thing, I guess, is one way to say it. And but to help, because of the way our mind is, to help us, we talk, we think in a dualistic way. And that just can help us sort of see what is here and now. I don't know if that relates. Anything else? Yeah, Marianne.
I have a question about that anxiety. Because I had that after the 9-day retreat, it was like then there's anxiety came up, and I, you know, I talked to you about it. So if that's something that is kind of always there, but we don't know it because we're always too busy on the surface, is that a stage when we get there?
I'll let you know when I get there.
Okay. All right.
If I get there. I don't know. But what I do know from my own experience that as my practice has gone along, I'm more clear of that anxiety. It's more omnipresent, and it's less of a problem. But it's very real and rich, and at times enlivening. At times it's deadening. It really feels like a rock, you know, in my heart, in my throat, or, you know, however it's being felt in that moment. But when the mind is more balanced, it's like it's like a whole churning of a universe. You know, sometimes you watch those Nova and whatever, and you get these sort of course, it's just some producer and scientist's imagination, but the idea of galaxies or even larger celestial bodies, and you just get a sense of some movement, and that's how these patterns of anxiety or whatever we're looking at, you know, at whatever sort of hierarchical level, whether we're feeling things emotionally, energetically in the body, mind, or we're looking at communities or nations or galaxies or whatever, it's just the play or the movement of life or whatever nature, you know. And then it's not a problem. You know, it actually feels very rich and even enlivening at times. But, you know, when my attention is less balanced and more superficial, you know, it feels like anxiety. You know, and sometimes terror. But I'm so used to it. Now I think one of the things that really changes is I'm not looking for an escape from it. It's tipped, and now my habit energy is much more about wanting to maintain a thread of awareness of it all the time, so as not to be surprised by it. So it's always there. I always know it's there. And it's just the sort of the pain of the world, you know. It's not even sort of my anxiety that's left over from whatever happened before. It just feels like this is sort of the background of the mind. And, in a way, it's what allows for the experience of freedom, because the freedom is not having a problem with all of this churning, all of this richness. It's not having a problem with it, not feeling limited by it in any way. And that's really the real taste of freedom, is when the mind realizes that it's not limited by what's being known. Still things being known, like anxiety, but it doesn't feel limited by objects or experiences or phenomena that are being known. As opposed to a freedom when the experiences being known are just right, they're really nice, and they're not afflictive at all, and we feel free, like when we're on vacation or something like that, around people that like us, then there's some freedom, but that's a very conditional freedom. Yeah, Ellen. Yeah.
And then you don't even realize when the actual change from being on one side of the fence to the other side of the fence happens. And it hasn't happened for me yet, but I'm just going by Sophie, who I think, you know, it wasn't a forced thing, and she just took her own time to get to let herself out.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds right. And the thing is, even though you said, like, I'm not there yet, but having the story of your dog Sophie and having observed that and maybe even observed it in many other formats besides this specific experience with your dog, we can have a lot of faith that this healing, this release process is unfolding, will unfold, can be watered, and can be sort of neglected. And then it really inspires us to get good at watering it instead of neglecting it. And as I suggested in the guided meditation, you know, one of the ways to water it is to remember it. You know, to remember that there is this possibility of freedom, not forgetting that, and always looking here and now, not being idealistic and kind of thinking it's out there somewhere else besides here and now. So I'll say a few things and save some time at the end for more discussion, but feel free to bring up something if it seems important as I go along here. So just a few moments to remind folks or to help people catch up. Last week we did the small group, so we won't have small groups tonight. We'll have them week 3, which isn't next week, but the following week. So keep that in mind. And I'll say a little bit more about what you might want to talk about in those small groups in 2 weeks. But last week, we did have small groups, and one of the things that came up, I think, in those small groups were these 3 questions from Jnanaponika Thera, this Western monk. It's the article that was sent. One of the links to one of the articles is his article. And there he's asking these three questions. So I just want to review. Is this world such a place of danger that there is a need for taking refuge? And we can just take a couple seconds and just reflect on that. Is this place, this life, such a place of danger that there's need for a refuge? And does such a refuge, or is there a refuge, does it actually exist? So assuming that there's a need for one, is there actually a refuge? And if we have any intuition that there is a refuge, what is its nature? And so just continuing, you know, tonight I wanted to spend some time, as I did with the guided sit, is just to be reflecting about the nature of Buddha as a refuge. Like, how might the mind awaken to that or discern that, intuit that? And of course, if something's going to be worthy of trust, like if something's going to be a refuge, it has to be available, accessible. That means, like, if for something to be really accessible, it means, in a sense, we have to carry it along with us. It's always here, which means it can't be external. So just sort of letting that in, that any refuge that could actually be a refuge would have to be internal, part of the nature of the body-mind, right here and now. And it would have to be actual as opposed to something that we construct. Because, I mean, I hope we all know this, but it's really important if you don't. We can construct things that seem very real. So we have to learn, like, you know, we can construct, I did as a child, you know, I was one of those kids, I grew up as a Catholic, and we did prayer, and it was just sort of expected that we do our prayers before we went to bed. And I was sort of just generally, in terms of my personality, one of those people that, you know, wanted to do things right. So I really got into it, you know, it's like, the more, if you did this many, that was good. But if you did more, that was better. But not just sort of in a rote, repetitive way, but even, you know, using my imagination. And I imagined God and beauty and goodness and, you know. And it was very real for me, as real as, you know, most of what we take for reality. Because most of our reality is constructed. And we can construct really powerfully beautiful things. And we can construct really horrid, fearful things in our mind. And even though technically they're constructions, they have real effects. I do this on retreat when I'm not being very mindful. Sometimes, and you've heard me mention this probably, you know, I'll construct a really beautiful meta image, and that will bring me to tears. But it's just sort of my mind indulging in thought, in emotion. Even though it's, you know, it's relatively wholesome emotion. Not all my indulging are wholesome like that. But just to sort of respect that we can do that. So as a refuge, we're looking for something that's not constructed, that is there regardless of what the mind is constructed, it's always there. That's how we know it's not constructed. Constructed things come and go. Like, once you stop constructing something, it's not there. So that's how we learn, like, a refuge has to be actual and not constructed. Something that is in the very nature of the mind or very nature of things as they are. And then the other thing we would want from a refuge is that it's transforming, that it actually has an effect. So this is something to look at. Like, as you're kind of messing around, looking for your refuge, and, you know, is it accessible? Is it actual? Or is it constructed? is it transforming? Like, does it leave, does it have an effect? So having connected or awakened to the refuge to whatever degree, in a sense, are you a different person than you were before? Has it changed sort of the shape or momentum of the mind, of the heart, that awakening, that connection with the refuge? Now, you know, one of the easy ways to sort of get our, you know, kind of get established with this practice, this interest in refuge, is to just become clear about false refuges, because this is just a lot, this work is a lot easier. And just to, you know, get a sense of things that we've constructed in our mind as a refuge and then turn out not to be a refuge, either because they're external, they're not actual, meaning we got to keep working at it. Like, if you have a refuge about becoming a Buddhist, and you've constructed this idea of yourself as a Buddhist, somebody who sits every day, somebody who's kind, somebody who's spacious, and but because it's a construction, we've constructed an idea of who we would be as a Buddhist, then you'll notice that that comes and goes. Like, we have to generate that idea and then generate the sense that we're becoming that, we're moving in that direction. And just, you know, it would be nice, you know, if we had enough time where everybody had an evening to just, you know, an hour and a half to just talk to us about every false refuge they had. From, you know, maybe some of you could remember back to 3 or 4 when your mom or dad was your refuge. And you thought, like, I guess they say, you know, I studied a little developmental psychology, and the idea is that at some point early on, I don't know, 2, maybe 2.5, 3, the parent is like a God figure. And initially, there's no separation. You know, the child doesn't distinguish self from other. But at some point, I forget exactly when it happens, the sort of brain, mind develops enough, and there's a sense of, oh my God, I'm completely dependent on you. Very much like some people imagine being completely dependent on God and connected and sort of submitting, in a sense, to that dependency. So if we could, you know, just hear from very early on every refuge that didn't turn out to be a refuge all the way through our life up until now. Even the Buddha, you know, in his, you know, his story, whether it's legend or myth or truth, doesn't really matter, but just it also paints the same kind of picture. You know, initially the refuge being, you know, being the really smart, really talented prince who had everything. It was really nice too. And sort of that bubble gets popped for him. Like, it's no longer a refuge. Most of you know, I'll just say briefly that the story, you know, of being taken around by his charioteer, his parents, his dad rather, had sort of kept him protected so he wouldn't see the way of the world. But at some point he got interested and had his charioteer take him around, and he started to see things he hadn't really seen clearly before, like, oh my God, what's that? And his charioteer said, well, that's a sick person, you know? People get sick from time to time. And the next day, traveling around, he sees an old person. Well, what's that? Well, that's an old person. Everybody will get old. And the next day, he sees a dead person. He didn't know what it was, and as the story goes, at least, and charioteer had explained, you know, what death was. And then the fourth day, he sees an ascetic, somebody who's left behind sort of the ordinary things of the world, like a nice house and nice relationships, and is looking for something, a refuge that isn't as fragile as things like wealth, things like health, things like youth, looking for something beyond. So these are called, in the Buddhist tradition, the divine messengers. They shook up the Buddha, and all of a sudden his princely existence didn't seem so perfect. You know, and he has this famous saying where he says, now he's talking years later, practitioners, before my enlightenment, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, I too, myself being subject to birth, sought what was also subject to birth. Myself being subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, I sought what was also subject to these same things. You know, because, like, he was on the path of being a noble king or whatever of his, that local fiefdom. The number one guy, you know, the good guy, the righteous, loving leader, you know, with a lot of power, who didn't get caught up in the power. But all that was something that was going to come and go. In the end, it wouldn't amount to much. You know, whoever it was, you know, any powerful, wonderful person, whatever it was, has come and gone. Even the great empires, you know, this is something we can reflect on. Even the poignancy, you know, of the United States as an empire, you know, just to see that that little, relatively speaking, little blossoming of sort of relative power to make things happen, you know, just see how fragile it is as things begin to change. Suppose that myself being subject to birth, aging, sickness, death, sorrow, defilement, having understood the danger in what is subject to these things, seek the unborn, the unailing, the deathless, sorrowless, undefiled, supreme security from bondage. Right? He's pointing to this freedom that we've been talking about. That's not about what comes and goes. Now, it's totally appropriate to be skeptical of this refuge. You know, if we're skeptical, we should really own that. We shouldn't pretend like, oh yeah, I believe in that. and then, you know, we go home and it's like, give me my TV show, you know, my milkshake, my friends, my house, my bed, my special pillow. Or if you like me, special pillows. The one between my knees, the one that's when I'm lying flat, the one that when I'm lying on my side. This sounds familiar for others. You know, these are our false refuges. I'm not saying we should abandon all our false refuges, but it's more about understanding what they are. Instead of allowing an unnatural dependency to arise with things that are uncertain, unstable, and impermanent. As long as they're here and available and not causing harm, well, of course, I'm going to have three pillows, one for my knees, one when I'm lying on my back, and one when I'm lying on my side. But when that's not available, you know, it would be really tragic if I have to suffer when I only have one pillow, or I don't have any pillow. It would be really nice if somehow the system adapts and adjusts and accommodates and does the best it can without whipping up some sort of personal tragedy, betrayal, because I don't have this or I don't have that. The Buddha said there are two lucid things that protect the world. And this is really what we've learned from all of our false refuges. They've, you know, every time we've learned that what we had taken to be a refuge, like a relationship, isn't a refuge because it fell apart. And then we have that wound, that betrayal. And that wound, though, is actually, it can be transformed into wisdom. These are these two lucid things that the Buddha is referring to when he says that they protect the world. What protects the world on this basic level are all of the wounds we've received from our false refuges, because it's basic wisdom. That won't protect you in the end. That won't protect you in the end. I mean, how many times, you know, have I been told by my friends and other people have been told, you know, about working too much or being too interested in money or even health or anything that, though in a superficial sense might be useful and wholesome, but if we use it as some kind of permanent refuge, we're putting all our eggs, that it's a setup for suffering, for disappointment. Another example of the Buddha's false refuge, remember, he tried out some things, including extreme asceticism. And again, whether it's true or just part of the legend or myth, but you know, the Buddha really took ascetic practices to the extreme, where it's said that, you know, when he would just touch his belly, he'd actually feel the back of his spine. And there's some pretty graphic sculptures you might have seen pictures of or seen reproductions of, where they just show the Buddha in his pre-enlightened stage as an emaciated ascetic, thinking that somehow by rejecting the normal needs of the body that he would have release from what's impermanent. So this is, you know, you could see how the mind does this. We do this after our betrayals too, right? If we feel betrayed, you know, to some degree the Buddha maybe felt the Buddha before he was a Buddha, when he was just a prince. Or bodhisattva means somebody on the way to becoming a Buddha. And thinking, you know, oh, I'm going to be a prince, I'm going to have this good life. And then he had some insight where he saw how fragile that was, how that wouldn't, it's going to come and go. It's not going to take care of him in the end. And he felt betrayed maybe by those years of investing in that. So, you know, then maybe we swing out to this other way. Well, forget the world. And that's generally, you know, leads us into ascetic practices. Well, forget the world. Forget eating. Forget relationships. How many times have we had a bad breakup and then it's like, forget relationships. It's just so much easier being alone until it's not easy anymore. then it begins to dawn on us. Maybe it's easier being with somebody. And we just swing back and forth like this. So the Buddha swung over into asceticism, thinking that that was the way, until he realized that that wasn't the way. And then, fortunately, he didn't swing over into total sense indulging, thinking that, well, if I just have really good sense experiences, I don't care if they're fragile. You know, he understood that, well, they may not be an answer, but there's no reason to be afraid of sense experience, like having a healthy body. So part of what we can do during this class is we can just be really honest with each other about our false refuges. And that may be something you want to bring up in the small group, and we'll have time tonight. Maybe people will want to share a little bit about our false refuges. And just have, you know, a sense of gratitude for the lessons that we've learned. So you may be, I certainly feel this way, you know, I'm in a really good relationship, an intimate relationship with my wife. And but I try to, as much as I try to appreciate it and derive strength and kind of an evenness of mind, that the safety, the relative safety I feel from it creates a real evenness of mind. I feel a certain stability, even though I know it's not going to last. But I try to cultivate a sense of independence, that this isn't a refuge. And so when things are rocky, then it doesn't feel like a betrayal, because I knew that however often I feel stability and comfort from it, I'm not presuming that it will always be that way. And I'm not even talking about breaking up. I'm just talking about just the normal rockiness that happens in friendships and partnerships. So once we have done our inventory, shared our inventory with others of the false refuges, it might really clarify then, what is a true refuge, something that's accessible and actual and transforming. And I'll just end tonight by taking a few minutes to go through how the Buddha talked about it. And many of you are familiar. What I'm going to bring to mind are things we study in the Buddhist studies curriculum over 6 years. And some of you have gone through it a few times. If you're relatively new, if you stick with it, you cover all this material. But one of the qualities of the refuge the Buddha points to is its lawfulness, its naturalness. And he often would start with the teaching on karma, that actions have consequences, or even more specifically, intention has consequences. And this may not seem like a refuge. It may seem like a big problem that my intentions have consequences. I wish my intentions didn't have consequences. But the fact that intention does have consequences, if we own that responsibility, it's a real refuge. Whatever you want to do, even if you want to have power over dominion over others, if you understand that intention have consequences, basically, if you understand cause and effect, you can get what you want, even if it's, in a sense, unskillful, like wanting total control. You can move in that direction of being more controlling by really understanding cause and effect. Right? There are people who are able to gather tremendous amount of power for a while because they understand how to play with, relate to causes, supporting causes, and they put together, of course they've got to deal with things that are not in their control. So even with our base desires, it's appropriate to understand things in terms of cause and effect. If you want to be the best diver so you can win an Olympic gold, you have to really understand cause and effect, and that how the intentions in your mind, what they are, really matter. You have to be single-minded in a way that leads to becoming the best diver in the world. If you want to be the nicest person, the calmest person, the kindest person, it's the same thing. So things like samadhi and sila, developing that balance and calm, easy presence, or developing a lot of integrity and kindness and generosity, sort of what we would maybe respect more than having dominion over others, But it's basically the same lawfulness. And the more we understand it and just see how it operates absolutely everywhere, intention, cause and effect is operating everywhere, and submit to it, I'll take it on as a refuge. This is just the way the world works, cause and effect. And as a human being, the primary place for cause and effect is the intention in the mind, has consequences. And as we respect it and pay attention to it, we can at least begin to shape our life in the direction we'd like to go. And doing that, as we get skillful at shaping our life, we begin to see what direction is appropriate to go in. Initially, we may think power and wealth is the direction to go. But then later, when we get all of that and we realize we still are neurotic and anxious, then maybe we'll seek out, we'll use our understanding of cause and effect and intention to seek out something with more stability than wealth and power, like loving everybody, and being really generous. And we might find that the happiness that comes from that, achieving that, is much more stable and resonant than the happiness that comes from having a lot of power and wealth. But even that's limited. You know, being the most liked person because we've been really kind and generous and everybody respects us appropriately. But even that is fragile because there are people who can hate us even though they have no reason to, but just because of their own projections and cause problems. So even that is limited, but it's really good to begin to master because it's concrete. We can really see that the lawfulness, because life, you know, often we feel a little paralyzed by how messy the world is and how messy our minds are and how seemingly out of control everything is. Although that's true, ultimately, in some ways, it's mostly misunderstood. And the way the Buddha taught generally was learn how to master the causes that we can master. We can learn to be really good at having intentions that lead to good results, happy results, in terms of being a really harmonious person and receiving the benefits of being a really loving and harmonious person, being a really clear, calm person, developing samadhi, and receiving the benefits that come with having a balanced, clear mind. And so we basically get to the top of the game. You know, we become that really beautiful, loving, bright person to whatever degree we can. And even that sort of is not perfectly stable. So the Buddha would teach about the three characteristics, about dependent co-arising. So he's saying that, okay, you want more stability, or more, going back to what Nora's saying, you know, we can even say more solidity, like solidity as a refuge, more freedom. More freedom from the world where things come and go. You want more? Well, you need to cultivate right view. So then the Buddha would say, okay, there's another cause that has effects, and that's around the view in the mind. If you view things from a self perspective, things will be inherently unstable. If you view things as nature, everything is just nature unfolding, no center, interdependently unfolding, then there's a lot more stability. Whenever we project a center to life, which is in flux, always flowing, there's always instability. As soon as that projection of a center ceases, all of a sudden there's stability. That's cause and effect too, isn't it? So then the Buddha would teach this as a refuge. Start cultivating the view that whatever you're experiencing is nature, inner and outer. You're experiencing your emotions, see them as nature. You're experiencing the thinking mind, see it as nature. You're experiencing sight, see it as nature. Sound, see it as nature. Whatever. It's just nature unfolding according to natural causes and conditions, interdependently dependent, co-arising out of that interdependent flow, movement. So we cultivate that view because it has skillful results, cause and effect. And then when we do that, and some of us have been doing that for a while now, our life starts to feel more stable. The ups and downs still happen. You know, I get defensive, I act on that defensiveness, causes problems in my relationships. So even though it doesn't mean that I'm not unskillful at times, but the pain of all of that isn't as disturbing. And the praise that comes isn't as disturbing. Because the mind is less often, less intensely projecting a center that's disturbed by what comes and goes. And it's more often seeing things as the natural movement of things. And then even beyond that, sort of seeing things as nature, is the fruit, is sort of the natural fruit, moments where it isn't, there isn't somebody, in a sense, trying to see things as the natural unfolding. It's just the mind, or just nature, maybe it's better to say it that way. And that, the fruit of that is just freedom. That not only are things okay, but they've always been okay, always will be okay. Doesn't mean the world isn't messy. Doesn't mean there isn't tremendous suffering and tremendous beauty. It just means in that moment, there's a resting in the totality. So in the totality, there isn't good or bad. It's just what it is. Here, words, of course, don't really work. But in terms of the refuges, or the refuge, you know, this is really what the Buddha, the word Buddha, is pointing to. This whole movement from just understanding things in terms of cause and effect, and really taking refuge in that lawfulness. I mean, we can trust that about the mind, about life, internal, external. We can trust that there is this lawful unfolding. And the more we follow it and develop our understanding of it, it really leads to this transformation of view. And the transformation of view leads to a profound experience of liberation or freedom, where there's a deep sense, an unshakable sense that there isn't a problem. It isn't a problem. And it really frees up the heart to live a life of love and compassion and generosity, because it's less caught in its neurotic view of things. So all life energy is still going to move, so it's going to move out of love and generosity, and not out of a self-centered fear or self-centered needs. So I'll leave it here so we have a little time. There's about 7 minutes. It'd be nice if there are any thoughts that come to mind, questions. Yeah. Mary. Yeah, I think so. The Buddha has a famous statement where he said, the mind or the heart is luminous and, you know, essentially undefiled or pure. Except, and I just read a different translation today. It's sort of interesting. Usually it gets translated, except that it's being visited, you know, by our habit energy or defilements. The tendencies of the mind that have been set in motion because of causes and conditions. And the new way I've heard it translated is adventitious, and I forget now what the second word is, but it's like these tendency of mind that will jump in, will arise when conditions are right. That's what obscures the natural luminosity and purity of the mind, the natural freedom of the mind. So there's nothing anybody can ever do to in any way destroy or ruin the natural freedom or the natural purity or natural luminosity of the heart or mind. Try as we might. But what can be done because of natural causes and conditions is this luminosity can be forgotten or obscured. Because in a sense, the attention, this part of the mind that knows, it gets confused by projections of the mind. Why did she say this to me? And the mind, in a sense, grasps that. So in the Buddhist framework, you know, how the Buddha articulates our existential situation, the essential problem is grasping or clinging. The mind fixating on something, and then by fixating on something, it loses the totality. And it becomes forgetful. It's obscured. And then from that point of fixation, the world looks different. So its response is going to be different. It's going to be neurotic. Because it's now living in a world that's defined by the clinging, the grasping, that tension. As opposed to, you know, from the, and again, please excuse the words because they're not exactly right. But from the totality, it's just free movement. You know, there's no friction. But from grasping, there is the appearance of friction. And then that friction is obscuring or confusing, can be, if it's misunderstood. So, you know, the thing is to understand cause and effect enough to bring the mind in balance. As the mind becomes more often in balance, it can't help it to begin to intuit this natural luminosity, purity, freedom of the heart or mind. The more that it begins to intuit that, the more there's kind of a change in the gravitational pull from gravitating towards contraction to gravitating toward release. It's like, now we take refuge in grasping. I grasp after having enough money so I can retire. I grasp after, you know, trying to make sure that Wynn is the partner I want to have. And see, that's how we ruin so many things, because we're grasping to hold, to make it some way that we think will make us safe. But it's based on an assumption that there's somebody who's not safe. It's like completely crazy, because we're solving a problem that isn't there. We're attempting to solve a problem that actually isn't a problem. And it's that attempt to solve a problem that isn't a problem that creates all the dust, all the obscuration. And on for a long, long time, as the Buddha would say. Any last thoughts? We have a couple minutes. Yeah. Say your name again. I'm sorry, I forgot it. Stacy. Thanks, Stacy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just deathlessness is just another word for freedom or nibbana or the unconditioned. And the reason deathless, you know, and it's nice to have different words because they, you know, words are never going to be great, but they can illuminate something. So, you know, we think of death, birth and death as some absolutes, but deathless, that throws the mind for a loop. You know, something that doesn't begin or end. See, so it's called the unborn and the deathless, so both. Something that's not born and doesn't die. That's the refuge. And it makes sense, you know, I'd want a refuge that isn't born and doesn't die, because I'm not interested in having something and then having to get something else because it's about to die, you know, or be born into something else. So we want something that's unborn and deathless. Mm-hmm. Let's just take a few seconds and let go of the words, take a breath or two together. And having a great sense of patience and vastness with this path. Part of understanding or intuiting the refuge is it really brings a beautiful, spacious relationship to the whole spiritual life. It wouldn't feel right, wouldn't be right to be in a hurry. Or to be fearful, even. Learning to uncover, to cultivate a trust in the heart, in the mind. Thanks everyone for coming tonight.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.